This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Professor Barbara Ransby of the University of Illinois at Chicago, and we're going to be talking about her fascinating new book, Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. Barbara Ransby, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
How'd you get interested in doing this book on Mrs. Paul Robeson?
Well, I actually encountered her quite by accident a long time ago. Of course, like everyone else, I knew of Paul Robeson and had been impressed and enamored of his political career, his artistic career. But I came across some letters and documents about her life when I was working in the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture in New York many, many years ago. And I actually wrote a short article about her when I was still an undergraduate. And then I forgot about her for a number of years. And when I was thinking of doing another project, I thought, I wonder who's written a book on Eslanda Robeson. And as it turned out, no one had. And so I returned to the project with enormous enthusiasm and expectation, and she did not disappoint me. I mean, just a really interesting, fascinating, and complex life. And so she held my interest for many years as I did this research.
Well, what fascinated you most about her? Why should we be so captivated by her?
Right. Well, she, you know, the title of the book is Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. So she lived this very large life. I mean, if you look at the breadth of all the experiences she had, it really covers a good part of the 20th century. She was involved in the Harlem Renaissance. She was an architect of her husband's early artistic career. They then moved to London, and she's a part of a very dynamic international community there in the late 20s and through the 1930s. She meets Emma Goldman. She has dinner with Virginia Woolf. They meet James Joyce. I mean, it's just a kind of who's who of the 20th century artistic and political world. And then she becomes very interested in politics and in Africa in particular. She travels to sub-Saharan Africa in 1936 under very difficult conditions. I mean, it's colonial Africa, 1936, at a time when, you know, travel is very precarious, and there are many, many racist stereotypes about Africa. And so she's defying all that. She becomes an anthropologist and a writer, and, you know, has her own career, but all the while sort of navigating this larger-than-life personality that is her husband. And, you know, there's other things too. You know, she goes to the front lines of the Spanish Civil War with Paul in 1938 and returns to Africa, visits New Zealand, and expresses solidarity with the Maori people. So, you know, just covering the world at a time when really most black women lived very circumscribed lives. And so I found all that very interesting and inspiring, and I was just curious to want to know more about her life.
Well, it is quite a story, and I didn't know anything about her, actually. I knew there was,
like most people,
I suppose, a Mrs. Paul Robeson, but I didn't know Jack about her. And
right.
It was really fun to find out about this character who was a very strong woman, very tough woman. You have a line in there about egotistical men who would refer to her as a bulldozer, but you say she really didn't want to be bulldozed over by anybody.
Right, absolutely, yeah. And she, you know, I use that term, Mrs. Paul Robeson, because she used it, but it shouldn't fool anyone to think that she was, you know, simply her husband's wife. I mean, she was her own person in every sense of the word, and, you know, traveled extensively without him, developed her own career as a journalist, you know, took principled positions, political positions alongside him, but, you know, really had her own independent mind and position in the world. So yeah, she was pretty tough.
It wasn't an easy job being Mrs. Paul Robeson either.
It was not. It was not, for a lot of reasons. I mean, eventually they settled into an open marriage. I think that came mostly from what Paul wanted rather than what she wanted initially. So she negotiated that personal dynamic in their lives. But I think a lot of people also were just so impressed and enamored and overwhelmed by what Paul Robeson represented and who he was. You know, he was just physically imposing and beautiful man. He was, had this captivating voice. He was, a brilliant intellectual and spoke multiple languages. And so he had this presence that I think it would have been hard for anyone to navigate around. And so Essie Robeson had that challenge, but she did not shy from it.
And for a while there, it looked like they were going to get divorced. I mean, he said, and they both, I guess, had filed for divorce, but it didn't happen. They decided to stay together. But they stayed together on terms that are, well, she came to a kind of a mature attitude or in on marriage and on extramarital sex, or one that is unconventional anyway in the United States. Do you want to talk about that?
Right. Well, yeah, they almost divorced in 1932. They began the proceedings but then reconciled. And during that time, Eslander wrote an article called I Believe in Divorce, in which she talked about very romantic notions that that people have about marriage and monogamy. And she wrote about that again when she co-authored a book with the famous China scholar Pearl Buck. And she said, people have very naive notions that one person is going to satisfy your every desire throughout your entire life, and this is ridiculous, and it's not what I expect, and it's not what most people should expect. And, so she went on to say that, she had determined that other people were not going to live her life for her, and that she and her husband did what they wanted to do and didn't feel like they owed anyone any explanation for it, and they were happy in that. But I think, to be fair, there were difficult times, and there were times in which the relationship was not on the terms that she would have preferred. But I think their relationship evolved. They were very much in love in the 1920s, and some of the other accounts of their marriage don't fully capture that. But there were these wonderful, luscious love letters between them. I can't wait to see you. You're everything. And so there was this genuine love when they began their relationship. And I think it matured as a different kind of love and comradeship and collaboration over the years. So they were always a family. They were devoted to one another. But they were not always one another's primary romantic partner.
And she was she played a lot of different roles as Mrs. Paul Robeson, and it sounded like she was, especially early on, his business manager, and then later on caretaker as he got ill, and always a political partner.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, when they started off together, they really weren't that political. We look at historical figures and where they ended up, and we assume, well, they were always there. But as it turned out, in the 1920s, they really weren't that political. But they were partners in terms of launching Paul's early career. And you mentioned Islanda's toughness. There's one story I tell in the book that I think really captures, actually several, but one which is particularly amusing and reflects the kind of personality she was. She was organizing a concert tour for Paul, and she had gone to the bank to get money in New York City, and she was going, walking around doing errands with this money for the tour in her purse. And a mugger came along and elbowed her and snatched her bag and was, making off with the money. And she basically, without thinking, chased him, grabbed him, pummeled him, took her money back, and, held him till the police came, and then proceeded with her day. And she wrote about it in her diary. She said, "How dare he see me as a target? I won't stand for that." So she was, this physically tough little woman, as well as mentally tough, and tough in other ways as well.
Fearless, indeed. I'm speaking with Professor Barbara Ransby, who's the author of this terrific new biography called Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson, who also, I guess, was called Essie most of her life.
Right.
How did they come to their politics then? You said they weren't political when they started off.
Right. Well, there were a couple turning points for Eslanda in particular, and we were talking a minute ago about the year 1932. That was the year that she and Paul almost divorced, and it was also a year that she went to Paris for a good part of the summer. And while she was in Paris, she met a number of very interesting and engaged people. One of them was a Dahomian exile and a member of a Dahomian royal family, now Benin, called Kojo Tuvalu. And he was a Garvey supporter. He edited a journal about, you know, black liberation, and he knew this coterie of black artists from the Caribbean and sub-Saharan Africa. And Aslanda went around that summer and met some of these people, Renee Morin, a Martinican woman named Paulette Nardal, and she interviewed them about their experiences living under colonialism, their experiences as intellectuals and artists living in Paris. I think it was really after that summer and her relationship with Kojo that she decided that Africa was going to be her life's work. She then went to the London School of Economics. She met Jomo Kenyatta, who was the future president of Kenya, who was one of her classmates. And in 1936, her trip to South Africa and Uganda really sealed her sense of being an anti-colonial activist. She met some of the future leaders of the African National Congress when she was in South Africa, and she really came to understand the brutality of colonialism, and I think that was really the pivot in terms of her own political awakening. Now, at the same time, of course, she and Paul were becoming increasingly interested in socialist countries around the world. They visited the Soviet Union, developed a close relationship with some people in the Soviet Union. Her brothers actually moved to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that was
odd.
So
her world is expanding.
You know, it was strange to see that her brothers had moved to the Soviet Union, so they had... Mm-hmm. What was the attraction of the Soviet Union for them? And it wasn't unique to the Robeson children. Among
right.
African Americans, the Soviet Union was different in their minds than in a lot of white Americans' minds.
Right, absolutely. Well, remember, you know, it was the Depression, the 1930s, and so many people were questioning the logic of capitalism, the morality of capitalism, the viability of capitalism. So socialism was, you know, in the air, and many people were talking about socialism. But for black Americans, including people like Langston Hughes and others, W.B. Du Bois, you know, famous African-American intellectuals, the Soviet Union represented a nation where, at least officially, racism and colonialism were not in its vocabulary, that the Soviet Union was explicitly in opposition to racism, in opposition to colonialism. Now, you know, if we look more carefully, there are a lot of contradictions and a lot of problems there. But Aslanda and Paul and Aslanda's brothers talked about walking around the streets of Moscow and not feeling the kind of racism that they felt on the streets of New York and Detroit and Chicago and so forth. So there was a sense of an opportunity to live as a person and not as a person discriminated against because of race. And that was the appeal that her brothers articulated and the appeal that they articulated as well.
Yeah, and that comes through loud and clear in this book, Aslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest is the author of the book, Professor Barbara Ransby. But let's talk a little bit more about her attitude toward the Soviet Union. She co-wrote a book with Pearl Buck. You mentioned Pearl S. Buck and mm-hmm. their friendship, the book, which I didn't know anything about before I read this. It's called mm-hmm. American Argument, and sounds like a really interesting book. I want to pick that up. Mm-hmm. You know, they argued about American patriotism, which is a subject that I like to argue about a lot. And and Aslanda's reaction to that was, you know, I guess Pearl Buck asked her, you know, are you ever proud to be an American or enjoy the advantages of being an American, and she said, basically, I haven't enjoyed them yet, right?
Right.
But
I'm still waiting to cash in.
Right. But the controversial thing in the book that was kind of horrifying, actually, for me to come across, and I wonder what your reaction to it was as well, is when she is defending Stalin and mm-hmm. Stalin's liquidations, and she said she wouldn't hesitate one moment to liquidate a mad dog. That is just kind of breathtaking in its coldness.
It is chilling. And I wrestled with that quote, and I really, you know, I can't fully explain it. I certainly wouldn't defend it, but what I did try to do is contextualize it, which is to say she actually wasn't directly talking about Stalin. When Pearl Buck used the term liquidation, she, of course, was talking about the purges. But when Aslanda used, when she responded to it, she gave the example of black people defending themselves against lynch mobs in the South. And so, you know, it was unclear how directly she would link that. But also in the wake of the Holocaust, it's just a chilling term to read. So yeah, I think she and Pearl Buck had very intense back and forth. And I think there are a lot of things that Aslanda said, wrote, confided in her diaries that were, you know, just unfiltered and perhaps not reflective of what she would have said in a more sober moment. But yeah, it's there in print, and I felt like I had to, you know, I couldn't leave it out, and I knew it would draw attention because it you know, it stopped me when I read it, and I read it over and over again to try to get the gist of why she would, you know, why she would say that and what she meant by it. So,
did she ever soften on this kind of a position, like after destalinization under Khrushchev? Did she ever talk about the trials or anything?
Yeah, you know, one of the things about both Paul and Aslanda, they never. There were a lot of things that they didn't say publicly and didn't record privately any place that I could find, but I cannot imagine that there weren't intense discussions about what was going on in the Soviet Union. You know, her brothers had lived there. One brother, you know, lived and died there. Their son went to school there briefly. So, you know, I think there's a lot that we don't know. They, of course, continued to have a relationship with the Soviet Union after Khrushchev denounces Stalin. And in fact, in 1958, when they're visiting, they're invited to come to Yalta, where Khrushchev is vacationing. So one would assume that there was a critical engagement with that history, but they did not publicly say very much about it.
And of course, their closeness with the Communist Party, both in the Soviet Union and in the United States, got them into a lot of hot water during the McCarthy period, even before. I mean, the FBI, mm-hmm. you have the FBI following her in the, I think, in the war years, right?
Mm-hmm. And the MI5, when the British intelligence is following her when she's traveling through Congo and French Equatorial Africa in 1946.
So the powers that be were not real fond of her. And also, there was a riot, the Peekskill riot in 1949 mm-hmm. when Paul Robeson was performing, and then there was a white racist riot outside.
Right, she was not there. There was the Peekskill event in 1949, and then Paul had given a talk in Paris in 1949 as well, and he was widely quoted and misquoted actually in saying that blacks would never fight against the Soviet Union, and so that caused an uproar. And then, you know, racist mobs attacked his the first attempt at a conference at Peekskill, and then there was a second conference, second concert planned, which was successful largely because there was a very, very large and multiracial security force that protected him and the concert. But yeah, there was essentially a riot. But she wasn't there. She spoke out against that after it happened. And I do want to come back to the McCarthyism and their persecution under, you know, during the Cold War. Aslanda was summoned to speak to testify before Joe McCarthy's Senate committee, the permanent subcommittee on investigations of the Government Relations Committee of the Senate. And this was the anti-communist committee where McCarthy was going to root out all communists and communist sympathizers, you know, under every, you know, rock and this. But Aslanda testified and was very, very defiant in her testimony and really challenged the very authority and legitimacy of the committee itself. And it's interesting because it was not simply her connection to Communist Party members, but it was also the book that she wrote in 1945 denouncing colonialism. She wrote a book called African Journey, and it was really a chronicle of her experience in Africa in 1936, as well as her anthropological work there. And it was because that book was on the bookshelves in State Department libraries around the world several of them apparently, that was the pretext under which McCarthy summoned her to testify before the committee. So, that's kind of ironic, too.
Well, I loved her answer to McCarthy as to whether she wrote that book. Can you talk about that?
Right. The first question was, we have this book by you, and, we think this book is subversive. Did you write this book all by yourself? And she said, I beg your pardon, of course. Are you suggesting I'm not capable of writing a book all by myself? I'm insulted, sir, by the very question. So she was, she started off, defiant, but with the first question she was asked. And then she goes on to both invoke the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, but also the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, and she was reprimanded. Of course, you can't, and why are you invoking the 15th Amendment? And she said, well, many of the senators on this committee come from states where black people cannot vote, and so I do not, I do not recognize their legitimacy.
Well, that jumped out at me, too, because I'd heard of witnesses invoking the Fifth Amendment and the First Amendment, but not the 15th Amendment. Was she the only one to invoke the 15th Amendment?
I don't think she was the only one. In various readings that I've done about testimony, I know that others did that as well, but she made a point to do it.
I'm speaking with Barbara Ransby. She's the author of this fascinating new book, which brings to life a character of American history, a woman named Eslanda. And the book's called Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. And she was more certainly than just Mrs. Paul Robeson. You use the word defiance. I just love her defiance throughout the book. And in 1952, in the darkest days of the Cold War and McCarthyism, she, published an article called I Know a Communist, where she came to the defense of someone who'd already been imprisoned for his communist views. I mean, she was really a fearless woman.
Right. Right. And they paid a price for it, Paul was blacklisted. They both had their passports taken for 8 years.
And that got in the way of them making a living, didn't it?
It sure did, yeah. They had bought, Paul was quite successful at the height of his career. He was as close to a superstar as a black man could come in those days and on a world stage. So they had, they had a lot of privilege and they had a comfortable income. And all that began to unravel during McCarthyism, and they were, they continued to be defiant. They had a home in Connecticut, which they had to sell, and the future was uncertain, but they persevered.
Yeah, it reminded me of Muhammad Ali at that point, where they're just, their ability to make a living was taken from them for them taking a stand. What was her attitude on feminism? You talk about that intermittently in this fascinating book. The one time a passage jumped out at me is about the United Nations, which we should talk about too, which she was very much involved with and very much a fan of and a supporter of to the end. But at the beginning, when it was founded, she had this quote, officialdom has a 19th century attitude toward women.
Yes. Yes, she was there at, a good part of her career. She was a correspondent for the United Nations. And interestingly, during that period of 50 to 58, when she and Paul were both confined to the United States, she still was very engaged with the world through her work at the United Nations. She would go there every day and wrote extensively about things going on throughout the world, from Asia to Europe to Africa. But she was adamant about the role of women in anti-colonial struggles, the representation of women at the United Nations, and this was very important to her. So when she wrote about the founding of the United Nations, she made this observation that here we are rethinking the post-war world, a world in which, men have perpetuated, untold disasters, really, in terms of war. And women are underrepresented. She wrote a number of articles about women's leadership and women, the importance of women's leadership. She also participated in several organizations, and I'll mention two. One is called the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, which is an organization she was in with a number of women, Alice Childress and Carlotta Bass and others. And it was a left-wing women's organization, but they spoke out against racial violence, and they also spoke in solidarity with women in South Africa who were protesting as apartheid was being put into place in the late 40s and early 50s. And then she also co-founded an organization when she was living in London later, She lived in London from 58 to 63. She co-founded an organization called the All African Women's Freedom Movement, which included women from, you know, the African diaspora. And they were, again, very immersed in the anti-apartheid struggle, in the anti-colonial struggle, and in solidarity with the growing Black freedom movement in the United States, but really supporting each other as women in those struggles. And, you know, I write about several friends she had who also had similar careers to hers, because it's always interesting to me doing a biography. I don't want it just to be about one person, but how that person's life can be a window to other people's lives, organizations, traditions, slices of history.
And there's so many interesting people from the 20th century who pop up in this book.
Right.
It's worth reading the book for that alone. But you did mention that the freedom struggle here. What was her role in the late 50s and 60s in the civil rights movement?
Right. Well, you know, after she and Paul have their passports returned in 1958, and they leave the country for the next 5 years or so. And that's a critical juncture in the freedom movement here. But they attended the famous prayer pilgrimage in Washington, D.C. in 1957. They were not on the podium. I think, you know, the realities of the Cold War were such that they were not included in the more liberal mainstream civil rights leadership at the time. But they attended nonetheless. Eslander reached out to Daisy Bates and offered support and admiration. Daisy Bates, the leader of the Little Rock desegregation campaign in 1957. And then she watched the movement from abroad, you know, from 58 to 63. They watched the March on Washington, and she wrote about it extensively for progressive publications and African-American publications in the United States. She meets Martin Luther King in London in 1961 and later writes a eulogy for Malcolm X when he dies in 1965 when they're back in the United States.
And had she met Malcolm X?
She did not. She did not. And there was an attempt to facilitate a meeting between Malcolm X and Paul Robeson, and Paul Robeson Jr. writes about this in his book, but that was never achieved.
Speaking with Barbara Ransby, she's the author of Eslanda, The Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. We have less than a minute left. What's your takeaway from looking at her and writing her biography and getting so involved with her? What do you take away from her? What do you think the reader should take away from her?
Right. Well, I think it challenges us to look for historical actors in all different contexts and places. And I think many of the women who were partners with famous men have their own stories to tell. And that's certainly true of Eslanda. But I think her legacy is one of Black internationalism, of solidarity with, you know, people in Vietnam, in China, throughout Africa, in Australia, in New Zealand. She had a very, you know, large sense of her political family, and that's a very important part of a Black progressive tradition that I think her life reminds us of.
Yeah, and just amazing people. Gandhi, she was big on Indian liberation, too. I mean,
we didn't even get a chance to talk about that. Yeah, she had a good relationship with Nehru and his sister, Jayalakshmi Pandit. Pandit's daughter stayed with her in Connecticut when their mother was in jail for her independence activities.
Yeah,
so just a very large life.
Well, it's a fascinating life, too, and a life that I knew nothing about, and it's always fun to learn something new at my old age. Professor Barbara Ransby, thanks for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.